For the week of February 9th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 480, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. How you doing, work wife?
Work wife? What are you talking about?
You're my work wife.
Okay, I don't know why you're even bringing this up.
Ryan Seacrest and Kelly Ripa have a new sitcom based on their relationship called Work Wife that's coming out. And I thought, darn it, we should have done that.
Except, you know, we're not all the famous. Good ideas are taken.
That's true. And we should say, or I should say at least, I was wrong about J-Lo. We covered the Super Bowl, but I didn't make clear one thing was that she delivered on the halftime show. That was the one part of the game that everybody agreed on. The halftime show was sexy and hot and good and fun and political and smart and all that sort of stuff. Sneakily political, I would say, though I don't know how sneaky it is to show children in cages. But, you know, it was strong. It was proud. It was great. The Super Bowl reached 100 million viewers, which was up slightly. And the halftime show reached 103 million viewers. Fox grossed $600 million in one day thanks to the Super Bowl. That is a lot more than the Oscars will gross.
Oh, yeah, that's probably true. But then, you know, I guess they're not selling, ads for $5 million for 30 seconds during the Oscars, are they?
Well, they're charging premium prices, and we should charge premium prices sometime in July because that's when we're going to hit episode 500. I'm excited.
Oh, you've already mapped it out.
I'm counting down.
Okay.
So that's what we're going to happen in July. But what's going to happen this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're actually still reeling from the Oscars. Reeling. And by reeling, it's like, you know, a double entendre that I just noticed. Film reel. Yeah, well, awards were handed out. History was made. Speeches were cut short. And people are already talking about the likely nominees for 2021. And once again, we were left out. But hey, let us revel in the details for at least another day. Here to help us sort out the most exciting moments and what it all means will be our guest, Ann Thompson of Thompson on Hollywood and IndieWire. Over in the Middle Kingdom, and frankly most of Asia, the coronavirus health crisis continues to rock the world, the economy, arguably the government, and definitely the area we care about most, the entertainment business. On Inside Baseball, we'll discuss why a writer's strike just got a lot more likely. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right. We're talking about box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. What we don't link to is the box office chart for China that we draw upon. Why? Because this week, there are two films on its chart. Two movies grossed any money. At number one in China is Ip Man 4 with $200,000 total. At number two is Sheep Without a Shepherd with just $100,000 total. Imagine you opened up the North American box office and saw that the number one movie in the country grossed, you know, $300,000. And the second film grossed $150,000. And that was it. That's what we're talking about in China, the second biggest market in the world. This isn't stopping anytime soon. I imagine some of this stuff will get back to normal in a few weeks, not months or 6 months or anything like that, but it's hugely disruptive. So it really has an impact on the worldwide charts and studios all over. Release schedules are going to be messed up for months to come. Anyway, looking at the worldwide charts, the number one movie around the world last week is Birds of Prey, the DC anti-hero. It grossed $81 million on its opening week. That's about what it costs to make. People said, it's lower than it should be, lower here, lower there, comparing this to that. The fact is they spent $85 million to make it. It opened up at $81 million. It's going to be okay, but it's at the moment not breaking out into a big hit. But I think it has good word of mouth and pretty good reviews for a comic book movie. So the story is not over for Birds of Prey. At number two around the world is the Will Smith flick Bad Boys for Life. $46 million last week. It's now at $336 million total. And number three is Oscar winner. It did win a couple Oscars, though not the big prize. It's 1917, the anti-war flick. It grossed $37 million this week. It's at $287 million worldwide. At number four is Doolittle, the Robert Downey Jr. flick. $32 million last week. It's at about $160 million worldwide. It's just about to equal the budget. That is not good for a movie that's been out a few weeks and gotten terrible reviews. At number five is Little Women, the Oscar winner for Best Costumes. That made $15 million this week. It's now at $175 million worldwide. That's a great success story. Jumanji, The Next Level is also a hit. That made another $14 million. That's at $770 million. Did you like how I did that sound mixing and editing? I created a sound special effect, which is sound editing, and then I mixed it into what I said, which is sound mixing.
You're going to win the award for sound editing and mixing all at the same time.
I believe next year it will be one award. So that confusion over sound that most people have, you'll just go, well, I had cool sound. And it might have been Ford versus Ferrari, or it might have been 1917. I got those two right, but it's sort of a coin toss at times. You know, when did they create the coolest special effects? And when did they do the best job mixing in all the levels of the score and the sound and silence at times and dialogue and effects and all that stuff? That's a really challenging job. Understanding the difference between the two is a bit of a challenge, kind of like Record and Song of the Year for the Grammys. But Jumanji did make money. And here is The Gentleman, the Guy Ritchie crime drama. Reverend Andy, my friend, saw the movie, wasn't so impressed, but it made another $12 million this week. It's at $60 million and counting. And number eight is Jojo Rabbit. $75 million worldwide, very well positioned to capitalize on the Oscars, as is the Oscar winner for Best Picture, Korea's Parasite. Another $10 million this week. It's at exactly $175 million worldwide. It's going to go wider this week in North America, and I'm presumably all over the world they're going to capitalize on it. And that's a lot easier to do when you have digital prints, isn't it?
Yes, it is. That's one of the reasons why you're seeing day and date openings, besides the fact that, of course, everybody's trying to cut down on piracy. That was one of the main reasons to go day and date worldwide.
Well, you also didn't want to make 500,000 prints of a movie.
And that was and one of the, yeah, correct. It costs a fortune. When you think about it, let's say $1,500 per print, $1,500, and you're releasing 8,000 prints instead of 2,000 or 3,000 prints, and then bicycling those prints or shipping those prints over to another country 5-6 months later, yeah, it starts to add up.
And it's really a low risk to say, hey, let's throw Parasite back onto a bunch of screens. You can do that very easily. You can program it out. If it turns out it's not working, you can easily pull them, right? The studio's not going to say you have to keep it on there for 2 weeks or three, you know. It's all
Well, no, because
like,
it's already you're out of your out. Contract period, yeah.
And everybody just wants to see, can we make some more money on this? And so
I've talked to art house programmers who said there were two films that were playing clean weeks later, and that they were Parasite and Jojo Rabbit. They thought for sure they'd be splitting both of those films by now, and neither were splitting.
Because they're still pulling in the crowds.
Correct, yes.
That's right. So by clean, you mean that they've got a full run of showtimes.
Yes, they're from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. It's just that film. They're not sneaking in a kid's film at like 2.
All right. Well, that was at number nine, Parasite. That's at $175 million worldwide. We'll see how high up it can go on the charts. It is historic. And number 10 is The Man Standing Next, another Korean film. This is that drama about the assassination of the country's leader, Park, back in 1979. That made $8 million this week. It's at $32 million and counting. And number 11 is the horror flick Gretel and Hansel. Bit of a flip there. That made $6 million and I jumped onto Knives Out. That made $7 million. It's at $14 million and counting, but it was made on a dime by Orion. Haven't seen the name of Orion for a long time, and I associate that with Oscar winners, that's for sure. At number 12 is the movie I saw for the second time. My mom wanted to go, so we went to see Knives Out. That hit the $300 million mark. You're welcome. That's all I can say. I also bought popcorn, so there you go. But I bought a kiddie pack. Do you know why? I asked for the kiddie pack at the movie theater because that's the only way to get a size of soda that's not the size of a small city. My mom is older. She literally cannot lift up the other sizes. They're too big for her. They're just giants. And if you ask for the small baby size and they give you this big, you know, 32, 46 ounce thing. So you order the kiddie pack for $8, you get a normal bit of popcorn, you get a normal size of 16 or 18 ounces of soda that old people and children can actually lift out of the holder, and everybody's happy. Except
you know, I think it was the Atlanta Falcons. I'd have to look this up. I'm going from memory. But I think the Atlanta Falcons opened a new stadium, and the owner said, look, I'm not going to gouge people on, you know, all of these sodas and hot dogs and everything.
That's the soccer guy, right? Oh, absolutely. That was them, yeah. Well, it's not gouging. It's just smart.
And sales went through the roof.
Right, of course. You're an idiot. They let people do refills at that stadium on their soda. So once you buy the cup, then you can go back and get refills. So you don't have to give them a tankard size because you're not forcing them to have it all at once. And it's sports, so you're more likely to leave your seat and come back and all that sort of stuff. But not forget the price. It's just annoying. I don't want that much soda and popcorn. Well, that's my story about Knives Out, which I actually liked a little bit more the second time. I enjoyed it the first time. I enjoyed the performances just a titch more on the second time. So it's a solid 3-star movie for me. I'm looking forward to the sequel. And number 13, there won't be a sequel to Spies in Disguise, the second Will Smith movie on the chart. This is an animated film from Blue Sky. That's at $163 million worldwide. Then is Cats, the musical, $4 million. It's at $70 million worldwide. Like Doolittle, it's not going to be remembered or it's not going to be rescued by worldwide box office. What did you think of James Corden and Rainn Wilson?
You know, I don't like people making fun of the movies that they're in that they got paid for that bombed. I mean, yes, I guess you can make fun of yourself, but you know,
but they're
people
not.
Lost a lot
they
of
made fun of the special effects, and you know what? Exactly. If you wrote and directed and starred in a movie, you can make fun of it. If you're the auteur behind it, yes, go right ahead. When you're an actor on a movie that other people worked really hard on, I do think it's super obnoxious to make fun of it. It's not that he can't make a self-deprecating remark about it, but he was literally on stage in the costume mocking the movie's special effects, which are mockable, but that's not cool. I don't think that was good. You're not taking the piss out of yourself. You're making fun of people that you worked with, and that's not cool.
Yeah, and I think that was the kind of undertone. I think people felt a little uneasy by it. And they didn't know why. And I think you've just defined why that is.
Yeah. The cats and the microphone thing was funny, however.
It's funny. They came back and they kind of took the unease, right? They did away with it by doing exactly, you know, what
making
you say.
Fun of cats, right? They were just right. Doing being cats, which is what they should have done in the first place. At number 15 is The Closet, another Korean film. This one is a horror movie. It made $4 million on its opening week. Then Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker is still chugging along. That's at $1.062 billion. And another horror flick below that is The Turning. That got a terrible cinema score of F, but that's at $17 million worldwide. And that's it. On the ComScore charts, there are only 13 movies listed. Normally, we bring in some more films from China and India because we do a little extra sleuthing to try and piece together what they're at worldwide and do a little basic math to find out what they made last week. This week that was harder because there's no China chart and it's just a slow time of year. But I think this is also really part of China, part of the coronavirus. It's impacting movie going in China. Certainly it's not happening there. I'm watching ice skating on television taking place in Korea. Every single person in the audience seems to be wearing a mask, a surgical mask. Every single person. You've got to imagine that this means people are less likely to go in public in countries where they're super aware of this health crisis. We're not seeing that yet in the U.S., but I think it's only a matter of time.
You know, so if you look, first of all, thank you for kind of telling me, giving me the heads up about looking at the Chinese box office chart. It's stunning.
Yeah, you never see that. It's like just going to Times Square and it's empty.
Right. It's like, so you have Ip Man 4 and it's the gross this weekend is 0.03. And that's number one. Number two, Sheep Without a Shepherd is 0.01. And then Extinction 0.00. The Hero Battle 0.00. And it's just, it's all zeros.
Yeah. You've never seen it.
And so, you know, you mentioned, you know, in China, this is an issue. Coronavirus kind of emptying streets out, certainly emptying the theaters out, movie theaters. And it's really disrupted everything from the supply chain for
everything.
Everything, you name it. It's disrupted the supply chains because a lot is manufactured in China. I'm not kind of telling you anything you don't know. But what is kind of not known is it's going all over Asia. So South Korea, movies are playing to empty movie theaters. Nobody's going to the movies in South Korea.
I have a friend who just moved to Singapore with his husband and they're, you know, under being very careful about where they go and what they do. It's everywhere. You talked about the supply chain. It's not that things are all completely built in China, but parts of everything are done in China. And so supply chains stretch all over the world. And if one little piece of that gets disrupted, that messes everything up. So you can't say, oh, well, we'll just move it to Korea or we'll move it to Singapore. We'll move it to Taiwan. It doesn't work that way because everybody's supply chain is affected by every other country these days. Video games, they are going to be delayed because of the health crisis. Bloomberg News had a story. They say the coronavirus shatters China's dream of overtaking the North American box office in 2020.
Well, if you read Celluloid Junkie, you'd know that was never going to happen in the first place.
Right, or if you listen to Showbiz Sandbox, it wasn't the coronavirus that did it, it was math.
Yes, there was no way. If you were increasing at a certain rate every year, and that rate was actually declining, okay, then, if you did the math, there was no way that 2020 was going to be the year that the Chinese box office surpassed North America's box office. It will happen, don't get me wrong, it's just not going to be in 2020, and coronavirus or not, it was not going to be in 2020.
And speaking of pop culture, the song from Les Mis, Do You Hear the People Sing, one of my favorite songs from that show, has become a signature tune of the Hong Kong protesters. The protest, political protest, has died down a little bit because people don't want to congregate in public. However, the death of the doctor, the very doctor who first publicly spoke out and said, hey, this looks like this virus is going to be a problem. This looks like SARS. This is an issue. He just raised it with other doctors on a message board. He was harassed by the government for warning about it. He is now dead. And his death has really sparked anger in people about a debate for freedom of speech and the Hong Kong protests and the government's policies and the totalitarian state they live under. So you never know what's going to shake a government. But people are singing songs from Les Mis and the Chinese government is worried.
Yeah, so the name of that doctor was Li Wenlin, who was an ophthalmologist who just kind of, as you say, Michael, just kind of...
He was doing his job as a doctor.
Yeah, this was all in the New York Times, and they were speaking to him a week before his death, just kind of going, you know, tracing it all the way back to patient zero kind of thing. And he just said, yeah, I said, hey, does anybody, this is kind of weird, this virus.
And he was called into the police station.
Yeah, they said, you better take that back. And he said, well, okay, I'll take it, but whatever, everybody's getting this virus, so maybe I was right. And he got the virus and was in the hospital when the New York Times spoke with him.
Yes, and reminds us that the doctor who first spoke up about the SARS virus and highlighted the government's cover-up of SARS, which of course led to more deaths and more illness than it was necessary. The same thing has happened now perhaps with coronavirus. That doctor is under house arrest because he called for a re-examination of Tiananmen Square. He's done that a number of times over the years, so he's been brave in multiple ways. And that guy has been drugged by the government, reportedly, according to the New York Times. His health is deteriorated. His family can't see him. It's a bit of a nightmare. But we were speaking about musicals and Les Mis, and that segues me into the fact that Spike Lee is making a film version of David Byrne's Broadway show, American Utopia. I was heartbroken I couldn't see this show on Broadway. I didn't get a chance to do that. I didn't have the money. So I'll get to see the film version. Hopefully, God willing, it'll be an equal to Stop Making Sense, one of the great concert films of all time. But that's cool to see. And that brings us to other musical news. Disney snapped up the film rights to showing the stage version of Hamilton. They filmed Hamilton on stage with the original cast 2 weeks before they all broke up and went their separate ways. That was filmed years ago. And now the show's been on Broadway for 5 years and remains a huge hit. Disney bought the rights to that performance, that recording of the performance. It's done more fluidly than the usual PBS capturing of a Broadway show. However, that's exactly what it is. It's like a glorified, you know, MetLife presentation. And Disney paid $75 million for the rights to broadcast that worldwide. $75 million. And I don't think they overpaid.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I'm sure that when you read the contract, it's $75 million. They had to hold on to it for 5 years. They couldn't do anything with it. They shot it in 2016.
Well, but Disney did not pay for the rights 5 years ago.
No.
Just bought it now. So that was the decision of the people behind the show and the people who filmed it, and Lin-Manuel Miranda, obviously. It was not the decision of Disney. They held on to it for 5 years before they offered to sell it to someone.
Right. Right, that was the
that was not part of the contract. No, it's not part of the contract.
No, what I was going to say is part of the contract for the $75 million are probably performance outs. Just like any time you hear, like, you know, Prince making, you know, $100 million for his record contract, that's what the value of the contract is. It's not, you know, $100 million in cash. It's if the albums perform. And I'm sure in this case, it's probably a huge chunk
of
front.
No. If they say if it crosses the $500 million mark, you get an extra $50 million. You don't get to pretend that you have paid $75 million for something. No, your performance bumps are not the cost of buying a movie rights to something.
I'm not saying performance bumps. I'm calling them performance outs.
No, but Disney did not say if it makes a lot of money, we'll give you more money, and thus we'll pretend we paid $75 million for it. Is that what you're saying? I'm saying they paid $75 million in cold hard cash. There may be performance bumps in it, but I do not believe everybody's pretending they paid more than they did. Because that
is
not paying
case,
$75 million.
In the case of Hamilton, I think you're probably right. There probably are no performance outs in this particular case because it's Hamilton. It's a phenomenon. Why wouldn't you pay $75 million? I mean, I wouldn't pay $300 million.
That's going to be the most of all time, and it will have to be one of the highest grossing concert films of all time just to make back that money. The highest grossing of all time is Michael Jackson's This Is It. That only made $260 million worldwide. It's not even a good, good complete comparison because this is a concert performance rather than a documentary film as well. But that's the closest comparison we can make. And that topped out at $260 million. This one has to make, our usual word of mouth, our usual thing, is $310 million. It's going to have to be, right? No, I'm sorry. It's going to have to make that amount of money just to break even, right?
Yeah, triple, and of course with marketing, budget. Yeah.
Well, that's
absolutely.
Why we say triple the budget, because we know you have to market it. And we know you have these other expenses. And then someday it'll be on Disney Plus. Nonetheless, that's a huge, insane number for what it is, and it does not seem to include the right to remake the movie as a live-action musical someday down the road. It doesn't seem to include that, from what I...
Yeah, I wonder if...
Everything I read said no.
The original backers of Hamilton, whether they get a piece of this. They must.
It depends on your contract. He had already done In the Heights. So right. When he did In the Heights, he became a huge commodity. So when they brought it to the public... showcased the show and had its first production of it. They got a piece of it, but not like they did for, say, A Chorus Line, or they would have for In the Heights, because he's now a big player. He's got big backers. They don't need the public. So the public got some part of the run, probably of Broadway, but probably not touring and the rest of the world. So depending on when you join that show, you may just get the Broadway, a piece of Broadway, or maybe a piece of North America, or a piece of the world. So it just depends on how powerful you are, how much money you invest, and all that sort of thing. So you're a guy who's coming late and helping them fund it for Broadway. You're lucky to be a part of it. You're not going to get a piece of the movie rights. So it's complicated, but I imagine only the big players who were there at the start that Lin-Manuel Miranda wanted on the show are going to get something like that.
I wonder if next year we will be talking about In the Heights, since I predict that it's a movie adaptation, which is a straight adaptation. It's not, a filmed version.
No. It's a full on musical, and it will be nominated for Best Picture.
You think so?
Absolutely. And seeing the trailer, it looks like a total winner to me.
I think it's going to make a fortune. And I was really surprised that Anthony Ramos Martinez, Anthony Ramos as an actor, he was on the Oscars last night, but he barely kind of mentioned that, hey, I'm the guy from In the Heights.
Well, they don't like to push that they're doing advertising. They had Janelle Monáe, who has her first starring role, her first lead role carrying a movie, Antebellum, that opens up in April. She's opening up the Oscar show. They often have young rising performers there who usually have a movie coming out in the following year. And Lin-Manuel Miranda did make a reference that, hey, that young man is a movie star, meaning, he believes he's going to be a big star thanks to In the Heights. And it will eventually, of course, the Hamilton will stream on Disney Plus, and NATO says, don't be worried about that. They say, we did a study, and apparently people who stream a lot of movies go to a lot of movies, says NATO, to which you and I say, yes, look at the people who watch a lot of movies on cable or HBO or rented a lot on VHS or DVD or Blu-ray. They always get scared of new technology, but all it ever seems to do is just excite people more about the joy of going to the movies.
I always go back to Austin Powers. The first one, it made like $50 million. And I'm just kind of, I just remember the $50 million figure because that was its box office gross, okay, in North America. Then I guess, what was it? The Spy Who Shagged Me was the first one, and Austin Powers was the second. I can't remember, but the second.
It was Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery, then The Spy Who Shagged Me, then Goldmember.
Okay, well, The Spy Who Shagged Me comes out, and in the first Weekend makes $50 million. Why? Because everybody saw it on video.
And loved it
and said, oh my God, how did I miss this in the movie theater? Well, guess what? They didn't miss the sequel.
Right. The first one made $70 million worldwide, just over $50 million in North America. And then the other two made $300 million worldwide. So that's a big bump. And it did. And I think it got an Oscar nomination for best song, I think, for that Madonna song. It might have, or it probably got costumes or something. I hope it did. But it is the end of award season, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And usually at the end of award season, actually almost always, we talk to Ann Thompson of Thompson on Hollywood and IndieWire. She's the editor at large over at IndieWire. Ann, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Of all the predictions, Ann, you did a great one last night. You always go every year to the Indie Spirit Awards, and you reported last night at 9:18. Well, you know what? People are really excited by Parasite here. I bet they're going to have a strong Oscars night.
And that was on Saturday night that you said that.
Yep.
Well, I've been sort of watching this phenomenon all season. It started at Cannes and it went on to the fall festivals and it went on, you know, to the opening party in LA, and then Bong was here living in Hollywood and with his family and going to all the different events. And I just watched and felt that enthusiasm. If you looked at the SAG Awards, the way that the audience jumped to their feet, even when it was introduced, the movie, not just when it won, you got a clue that it was going to win. And so you had the actors behind it. You had that enormous group of the Academy behind the movie, and they just kept slowly, steadily building at the box office. All over the world, by the way. And there was an international component to the voters that really kicked in. Almost 20% now of the expanded membership of the Academy is international. And it just all came together, this sense of, you know, every year it's about the zeitgeist. It's about who are we? What do we want to tell the world about Hollywood? It's always about that sort of reflection of who Hollywood wants to be. And maybe at a time when inclusion isn't what it should be, they wanted to send that message this year. And everyone rallied. It just was extraordinary to be in the room when everyone was cheering and stamping and yelling for this movie.
Well, and so, okay, so you said it's about the zeitgeist. What is that zeitgeist now? What does this say?
Well, part of it is that first of all, if the movie didn't play, if it wasn't funny and accessible and a thriller with genre elements, if it didn't have all of those things combining, and guess who does that? Hitchcock. Hmm. Bong Joon-ho is the closest thing to Hitchcock that this generation of filmmakers has produced. And I think that it's more than that. It's the haves and have-nots, the message of the movie that gives it a certain gravitas that's about who we are in America. God knows the corporations run the show here. And there are extraordinary billionaires and a lot of poor people in this country. Now Joker was telling some of that story too, but this and that translated with over $1 billion at the global box office. But this was the film that the Academy voters wanted to send out into the world as representing them.
And let's face it, if you follow awards, having something like this happen is really exciting because it's the first time in history that a foreign language film has won Best Picture. It's at least 60 years overdue, going back to the era when the French, Italian, and Swedes were dominating the conversation, but it's really 100 years overdue. It should have been happening right from the start. And up next, please God, animated and documentaries. One of those should win Best Picture as well.
I couldn't agree with you more, although that's going to be a longer road.
Yeah, you know, look, I honestly thought, okay, Honeyland, which is a movie, a documentary, I loved. I thought it was one of the best films of the year. And I thought for sure, and I guess I also knew that American Factory with the Obama contingent behind it was probably going to win because it was a story that more people could relate to. But it was nominated for Best International Film and best documentary, I thought, well, that's got to count for something, right?
It's a huge thing. It's the first time that's happened. And a lot of people talked about Honeyland and loved Honeyland. But in international, they couldn't beat Parasite. That was inevitable. And in documentary, they couldn't beat American Factory, just for the reasons you describe. And Netflix did win two awards after all, finally. They got Laura Dern for Marriage Story as well.
Yeah, but that's great wins. I mean, people said, oh, Netflix lost. No, they didn't. They won the most nominations. They got mentioned 1,000 times, and they're making really good shows and movies that people want to see.
Michael, you are correct, and that is the right way to look at it. And they aren't crying in their beer. They got exactly what they wanted, getting people to tune into their website and watch their movies.
People could not, ABC could not get people to tune into the Academy Awards.
It was the lowest rated ever. And I think it has to do, I would be curious to know what you guys think. All of us lily-livered liberals, you know, love, inclusion and making fun of the directors not nominating a woman, you know, no vaginas, as Chris Rock pointed out. But this was the most woke Oscars ever, produced by two women. One was a woman of color, Stephanie Lane, and the hippest music, the best musical Oscars I've seen in a while. But at the same time, there was a lot of lecturing going on, a lot of reminding people of what was missing. And I felt, I wondered if a lot of mainstream America didn't finally tune out.
Well, doesn't it also have to do with the actual movies that are, leading the pack?
Joker was, as I said, a huge hit, and so was 1917. And that didn't seem to work. That didn't seem to make any... I would suspect that, I don't know how this happens, but I would suspect that as the night progressed, people just sort of went, and tuned out.
Yes. Doesn't it have to do with the way the show is presented and performed? Did you think it was a great show creatively?
I thought it was a great show. I had a great time. It worked for me, but I'm not the tar. There seems to be a kind of liberal Hollywood Oscars that is distinct from a larger conversation in America about movies that they care about. Do you see what I mean?
David Ehrlich, actually, over at IndieWire, he tweeted out last night, and I know he loves Little Women. He is a big Little Women fan. And he said that that Little Women has won more Academy Awards than 1917 and Joker combined. I think Little Women won two awards?
One for costume.
Yeah, it doesn't work because...
And Joker won two.
No. Oh, yeah, no.
Joker
right.
won two for...
And 1917 won at least two.
It won composer and best actor. And 1917 won three. It won VFX, sound mixing, and cinematography.
Yeah. Well, so Sperling got his facts wrong, but you didn't. On your
No, I was quoting David Ehrlich.
Well, are you sure you're quoting him right? But Anne predicted 19 out of 24 of the
Which is the just winners. Okay. That's not so good.
No.
Which
you
ones
know
were
what? I did pick that Parasite was going to win about four, and I got them wrong. In other words, I went with Tarantino for screenplay because I just felt there was some support for that movie, but it settled for only two.
Well, I'll tell you what shocked me, and it will shock almost nobody because they didn't see them, but I couldn't believe that The Neighbor's Window won Best Live Action.
Me too. Tour. I was very surprised. You know what I realized afterwards? Sometimes you realize, oh, I should have got that. It's because because of the filmmaker himself was very well known to the people in the Academy. And he had won before for a doc. And so he had turned to live action. So they were supporting him.
Oh, I thought the message
it was
of the
a
movie...
moving short. It did make you cry at the end.
No, I got so angry. I felt like it was giving this mother, young mother, grief for being overwhelmed with the children and telling her, yeah, you know what? You have it easy, sister. Stop complaining. I thought she really had a hard time. Her husband was sitting around doing work on the...
I didn't see it that way. I didn't see it as criticizing her. I thought it was clever because it made you think, you were watching some kind of voyeur, looking at someone else's life with envy, and then it brought you back to reality. I thought that was good.
I thought it was well acted, but there you go. There's always something to surprise you at the Oscars. But then people will try and use this year to predict what happens next year. Well, you see now, because you can never, every year's
pressed. No, you always learn. Sometimes you learn with Olivia Colman or Juliette Binoche, you learn the lesson, they take the high road. Or the British actor who won for the Spielberg movie, Mark Rylance. Mm-hmm. You know, you go, oh, okay, they take the high road. And sometimes you learn that it's a different lesson each time. You just sock it away.
What is the lesson? And Michael and I were talking about this before we started recording today, of Renee Zellweger winning the Best Actress, when how many people actually saw that movie?
They saw it in the Academy. I mean, they saw all the movies. I don't know that they, one of the other things about Marshall Curry is that a lot of the Academy members never got around to seeing the shorts. The season was shortened by 3 weeks. There was a crash on the Oscar site. They didn't get sent their DVDs in a package like they were used to getting. And they were scrambling at the last minute to watch all the shorts and the docs and the animated films. They really didn't see them this year. So it almost was the people in the shorts and animation branch who voted for those. I'm telling you, it was probably the smallest number ever.
Well, yeah, let me ask you, because I was up at Sundance, keeping an eye out for you, by the way.
I wasn't there.
I never ran into Anne. I thought, this is like a weird Sundance. I mean, I've got to get out more, maybe stop seeing so many movies, because I haven't run into Anne. I haven't run into David Ehrlich. Now, David was there, and I did eventually run into him. However, I never ran into you, and then I realized, wait a second, look at all these tweets, look at all these news stories from, wait a second, Anne's not here, why not? And it's because of this shortened award
I just
season.
Looked at the calendar at some point early on and figured, because I was figuring out my whole schedule, and I went, oh my God, I can't go. I have to come back for the nominations lunch. And I was miserable missing it. I'll be back next year. I saw a lot of things on links. I mean, I wasn't entirely out of it, but it was just impossible this year.
Certainly the publicists that I've spoken with hated it.
Everybody hated it. And it won't be repeated. It'll go back to the old ways.
Isn't it just because of the Olympics, though? Won't it happen in every...
They were overreacting in a way, because there had been this really long season when they skipped the... You know, they had to wait for the end of the Olympics, and it was weighed into March. It'll just return to February. It'll just return to 3 weeks later from what it was. It was literally 3 weeks earlier this year.
Well, and I after you said that last week, Michael, I kind of looked at it and went, wait a second, it isn't the Winter Olympics this year, it's the Summer Olympics.
Yeah, it doesn't happen every year. It's every 4 years that happens.
And by the way, in David Ehrlich's, and I guess my own defense, so David was tweeting during the Oscars, and he said, Little Women now has more Oscars than Joker in 1917 combined, and he finishes it by saying, and I'm sure this tweet will age beautifully. So it must have been in the middle.
It was early in the night.
So you need to pay attention to his joke, Sperling.
And know when the jokes occurred. It was a timely joke.
Exactly. Not a timeless joke. Is there anything timeless? This year obviously is timeless for being the first international film. The change from foreign language film to international film, that was great. And I think that was cool of Bong to acknowledge that and make a point of celebrating that. It's a real sea change for Oscars. When you look at Moonlighting, and now this, that's a really radical, hip turn for the Oscars.
It felt a lot like Moonlight. It really did. But it also felt like a reaction against Green Book. Mm-hmm. And it really, as sort of a swing back against the sort of old white male establishment of Hollywood. But the truth of the matter is that many of those people were rooting for Parasite, no matter if their own studio had a film that they should be rooting for. That's what I learned last night at the Oscars.
And no doubt 20% of the people being from overseas, not in the United States or internationally born, is a huge factor.
Absolutely. But it wasn't just them, or it wouldn't have won. That's what I'm trying to say. It kind of unified everyone. You know, there were partisans for 1917, partisans for Tarantino, partisans for Joker, obviously with 11 nominations. But in the end, Parasite was the one they unified behind with a great deal of passion.
Now, Roma had a lot of passion behind it, but, and you know, just follow my logic here, Roma was kind of controversial in one regard. And that was, it's a Netflix film.
Yeah, but I would argue that it was more than that. Because, yes, there was a huge, and we're talking about last year, the studios united in their fight against Netflix. That's what made Green Book win. In this case, everybody was uniting behind Parasite, even the studios, and it was a box office hit. It wasn't a Netflix movie. The Netflix movies all lost steam over the course of the season because they weren't in theaters as long, and they didn't have that sense of building momentum. They lost it, and Parasite kept it, and Parasite really stayed in everybody's minds.
Well,
one thing I'll point out is Parasite was actually picked up, and by picked up, I mean before it was even made, by Neon, which is a, you know, an offshoot, if you will, of the Alamo Drafthouse. At least it's got, you know, one
they're
owner
partner.
That's similar.
They're partner.
Yeah, they're partner.
Yeah. They did I, Tonya. You know, they're a viable. They had a great year. They did Honeyland and Apollo 11, and they had an amazing year.
Do you think Netflix will wind up seeing the light of day, or seeing that they have to keep movies in theaters for a little bit longer if they want to win these awards?
I don't
or they
think
don't care.
So. I don't think they care. I think the theaters, you know, each of these movies stayed in theaters as long as there was some traction, and then they slipped away, and they went on. It's sort of like they're using the theaters as a platform in an old fashioned sense, but instead of going wider into more theaters, they go to Netflix. That's their platform.
They go home.
and exactly. And so that's the new paradigm. And by the way, that's the paradigm that Amazon is using more often than not. And the various deals at Sundance were streamer / distributor deals, where the streamers paid the most money. And maybe they'll launch in theaters for a few weeks, but then they'll end up streaming. That's the new normal.
What's your favorite detail that we didn't see when we were watching the show on television? Some behind the scenes scuttlebutt.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh boy. I'm
sorry. Well, what was your happiest surprise? Your happiest win? Or your best speech?
I was very moved by Laura Dern, actually. I was moved by some of the speeches, even Joaquin, when they brought up their parents, when he brought up his brother. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of genuine emotion that catches you by surprise when Laura Dern called her parents her heroes. And the other moment for me was Bong, when he accepted director and set up the standing ovation for Martin Scorsese. That was moving to me.
I liked it when he said, "I'm going to drink all night."
On that note, I had too much last night. I gotta go back to finishing my story. Well,
before you do, let me tell you, we don't know the votes on the movies, but we do know what the nominees are going to be for 2021. They are, everybody's talking about Jamie, the British musical, In the Heights, the Lin-Manuel.
Definitely In the Heights, no question.
King Richard, starring Will Smith as the dad of Serena and Venus Williams. The Last Duel from Ridley Scott, News of the World starring Tom Hanks, The Personal History of David Copperfield, Soul, the Pixar animated film, The Trial of the Chicago 7 from Aaron Sorkin, and West Side Story. That's right, a record 3 musicals next year.
Something to look forward to. There's also Leos Carax with Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard, which people are praying will actually make it to Cannes, and that's a musical also.
Oh, cool. Do we have a title?
I forgot.
Okay, cool. Well, great.
Do any canned films have titles? They're always just, I went to see the Tarantino. I went to see the Bong Joon-ho.
That's exactly right. It's auteurs, I mean, nobody, all the way.
Now, speaking of Cannes had a big night.
That's it. They were there in en masse, Terric Frémaux and Serge Tubiana, the Unifrance contingent, because, of course, Bong Joon-ho won the Palme d'Or. So they're cheering him on. I think The Artist was the last time that happened.
Yes, correct. And I certainly look forward to seeing you in Cannes this year, although I guess we'll be seeing less of each other since you won't be staying with us this year.
I know. I wasn't the one rooting for that, but I remember I was the spoiled creature that had her own room. right? So
that's right.
Everybody else with all the boys are sort of bunking with each other in close proximity. I do look forward to a proper sized bathroom.
Yeah, well, it is France.
But we'll see each other, I'm sure.
I hope so. And thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Lovely. I enjoyed it. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that was great of Anne Thompson to join us on the show. You know, even though the Oscar ratings were down, I still think it's a big deal that Parasite is the first foreign language film to win Best Picture. I'm still angry it wasn't Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. I'm still angry at Gladiator. I really thought Crouching Tiger was going to do it.
Well, okay. So you said, how many did you get? Right.
I got just 17 out of 24.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I picked 1917 as well. I saw the film the day before the Oscars, and I thought, I don't know how. I mean, I love Parasite. Don't get me wrong. I love Parasite. But as a feat of filmmaking, 1917 is something else.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just an amazing movie.
Out of those 9 films, that would be the one I voted for. And that tells you I ignored my single most important rule when it's doing an Oscar ballot. If I would vote for the movie, it's not going to win Best Picture. It almost never does. 19 times out of 20, that's proven true. So the fact that I would have voted for 1917 out of those 9 flicks, that should have told me, no, go for Parasite.
Well, here's my question. Does it work the same way for you and politics? Because if so, have I got a Republican candidate that I need you to vote for?
I did use the words big and deal. So I think it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop. That is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Sperling, what is our first story?
Our first story, well, Billboard is calling it, get this, Vinylgeddon. The Apollo Masters plant in California, it's in Banning, California, is one of only 2 in the world that manufactures lacquer. Now, lacquer is a material that is instrumental to the making of vinyl records, and it just burned down.
If you are in music and you hear just Apollo Masters plant just went up in flames, that would send a chill down your spine.
Yes, especially if you are a record label, no pun intended. You know, if you're a label and you know what Apollo Masters is, you're like, wait, what? Because vinyl is now 25% of all physical music sold, and you need lacquer to make vinyl. The only other source is the MDC plant in Japan, but Apollo provides an estimated 80% of the worldwide supply, or rather, it did supply that. No employees were harmed, so that's good, and the company has no idea if or when it might rebuild and start production again. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal, even though physical sales are much smaller. It's not going to impact the bottom line that much. It's still a big deal because it's just the heart and soul of music. We're looking at that vinyl, and it's more important than ever now that music is digital and CDs have, you know, almost disappeared. So vinyl is really the heart and soul of a lot of stuff, and seeing it like be that threatened. Only 2 plants in the world, and one of them does 80% of all lacquer. Oh my gosh, that is talk about supply chain. That is a real blow.
Well, you know, I can tell you, Patrick Von Sikowski was here in Los Angeles. My partner from Celluloid Junkie, he was here just this past week. And I had a stack of vinyl records that he had shipped to me because it was cheaper than shipping it to him in the United Kingdom. And so when I saw him, I brought a huge stack of vinyl records for him that he had ordered and had shipped to me. So, and he warned me, don't get into collecting vinyl records. It's an expensive hobby.
Were they new albums or like classic stuff?
I don't know. I didn't ask.
Oh, okay.
I should, and they were all packed up. Yeah, I'm going to find out. Now, the CBS streaming service, CBS All Access, there's a real original name for you.
Yeah.
Well, it's about to get supersized. Now that CBS and Viacom are back together again, they've taken a look at CBS All Access and thought, you know, we can do better, especially with that whole name thing. The site already boasts well-reviewed shows like The Good Fight, and not only one, okay, not just one, but 2 Star Trek shows. Yet it's going to get a major injection of content and probably a new name. In other words, they're looking at the HBO Max and looking to go one better. So you'll see content from CBS All Access, plus Showtime, plus MTV, and Nickelodeon, and BET TV, and Sports, and Live News, and Paramount Pictures, and Pluto TV, which, by the way, that last one no one has ever heard of, but it's still a thing, I guess. They'll mix it all together and call it Showmax, or Maximum Show, or Showtime Plus or Super Showtime or Showtime All Access. You better not name it Showbiz Sandbox, because if you do, we're going to have a little talk, okay?
Suing.
But they're definitely, I think, not going to call it Pluto. And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It's an obvious step. I thought the name was poor. I thought it was just sort of a, why are they just doing the CBS All Access? It just seems so secondary. You know, it just felt like, well, you know, if you go with Hulu or whatever, it just felt lame. Not that the content was lame, but there you go. So I'm glad that they're saying, you know what, we need to make this bulk up. But they're also saying, gee, maybe we shouldn't have sold South Park to HBO Plus. Maybe we shouldn't have sold all that Nickelodeon stuff to Netflix. I mean, they've rented it, of course, but it's going to be a decade before they can get those crown jewels back and have it on whatever they call this puppy. But they're going to want to do that someday. 10 years from now, we'll be talking about how South Park is leaving HBO Plus to go back to Showmax or whatever it is. So, you know, I don't know why they didn't see this long term. I guess it was because they were separate companies. But still, you know, Star Trek will be under one roof. All the films, all the TV shows will be available on this new service. That's going to be a powerful thing. That's great content. So it's this new stuff that they've made, adding it all together. It's just one more damn thing we got to pay for, right? You know, we don't want our cable bill, but we do want to pay for HBO Max, Disney Plus, Amazon Prime, CBS All Access, blah, blah, blah.
Well, you know, I can tell you that you said that it feels like, it was kind of secondary in their minds with that name. And you're right. It actually was. If you think about how long it took for CBS to get into the streaming game, it most definitely was like, you know.
Well, they were the one making the most on syndication and worldwide rights. So they were probably the last one who wanted to get into that game. The type of shows that they made make a fortune worldwide. NCIS is the most watched television show in the world right now. NCIS, which you haven't thought about in years, probably. You know, CSI used to be the most watched show in the world. Baywatch was the most watched show in the world. CSI is coming back to CBS as a miniseries with some of the original stars like Will and Peterson. They said, yeah, these make lots of money. You look at The Blacklist on NBC. Why is that show still on the air? Because it makes them a ton of money worldwide. And they don't talk about it, but that's where the money is for them. And that's why it took them so long to pivot to streaming.
Hey, is that an ad on my YouTube video? Why, yes, it is. Quibi may think short videos are a bold new format, but YouTube has been feasting on short, medium, and long videos for quite a while. For the first time, its parent company Alphabet, aka Google, is breaking out some figures. It turns out YouTube generated $15.1 billion in fiscal 2019.
That's real money.
That's a lot of cat videos, by the way. A lot of cat videos. I'm teaching my cat to play piano right now, as a matter of fact. That's also a lot of money, and it's exploded in the last few years. According to Google, YouTube grossed $8 billion in 2017. Also a lot of money. But in 2018, just 1 year later, it grossed $11 billion. So now it has doubled its ad revenue in the last 2 years. How, you might ask? Well, actually, I don't know, but I'll search for a video on YouTube that tells me all about it. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. And in fact, joke about cat videos all you want. We've got a link in our show notes. I searched for cat videos. You'll find endless videos with millions of views and tens of millions of views and hundreds of millions of views of cats, all with ads, all free content created by customers. So yeah, don't laugh. Plus, I don't know how they doubled their ad revenue in 2 years. I looked all over to try and find some explanation for this. I don't have one. If you've got an idea, tell us about it.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, and Facebook. You can like us there, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox.
Well done. You know, that was our latest call out, our first call out for viewers to contact us, and you didn't drop the ball. You did a nice job. Keep going.
Well, the Disney Plus streaming service. You know them? You know them? Yeah. Well, apparently, yeah, they're a hit, okay? After less than 3 months, that service has 28.6 million subscribers, making Disney headquarters the happiest place on earth. You know, next to that other thing they have, that land, that Disney thing, that Disneyland.
Keep going.
In comparison, after years of existence and an Emmy for Best Drama, Hulu has 30 million subscribers. Head Bob Iger says the ongoing closure of theme parks in China due to the health crisis will result in hundreds of millions of dollars in losses. And that assumes, by the way, that the parks will be up and running again in 2 months. Iger had less to say about the departure of the top Hulu exec Randy Freer and Fox head Emma Watts, a key player in the Avatar sequels. Iger would much rather discuss all the Baby Yoda merchandise hitting shelves soon, not to mention season 2 of The Mandalorian in October, and more characters and more TV shows based on Star Wars coming sooner rather than later. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's not fair to be a big whoop. It should be a big deal, but we just knew and assumed and expected that Disney Plus would be a massive out-of-the-box hit, and that's exactly what they've delivered, along with a show that a lot of people want to see. In fact, I have friends. I'm going to get arrested by the FCC or something, or the government's going to come down, but I know people they were telling me about it. I was, oh, have you seen The Mandalorian? And they said, yeah, yeah. We were like, oh, so are you buying Disney Plus? They're like, no, our son came home from college and shared the password from his room. I'm like, you stole a password from a college student? It's supposed to work the other way around. They're supposed to steal passwords from you.
Well, speaking of subscribers, the music streaming service Spotify has a lot of them. 124 million of them, to be exact. How did Spotify do it? I'm not sure, but there's a YouTube video that I'm sure. No, they are adding tons of podcasts. That's right. Tons of podcasts, spending $400 million in 2019 to grab podcasters. And just this week, snapping up the Bill Simmons network of sports and entertainment shows called The Ringer.
Are available for sale.
Dirt at showbizsandbox.com. Daniel Eck. Call us. They've extended free trial offers across their entire range of subscriber levels, and they're making less per subscriber. Their monthly average revenue per premium subscriber fell 5% to $5.12. Mind you, in the most recent quarter, they added 11 million subscribers, so that's a record, but not a vinyl record because, of course, you can't make those given what we just talked about. Anyway, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal in the future in terms of their podcast and all the other stuff they're doing. I don't know. We don't have a breakdown, but I sense it's really a play for the future as opposed to driving subscribers to them right now. But when you're getting stuff like Bill Simmons, he has a lot of fans and they are going to follow him. So that could help. And seeing the average revenue per subscriber fall is okay. That's what happens when you've maxed out on the most expensive countries, the wealthiest countries in the world, and you want to expand to Africa and to parts of Asia and whatever that are not as wealthy. And India, you're going to make less per subscriber. And that's good. That means you're adding more people. There's no reason it should cost the same in India as in North America, not right now with income levels. So don't freak out. That's a good sign that they are reaching more people and pricing their product right.
Now, this next story, talk about karma. Radio personality Rush Limbaugh announced he has advanced lung cancer, but will keep working as long as possible.
Give Limbaugh, that man a Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Well, done. Check. Limbaugh has been a force in radio for decades and a fiery right-wing commentator with a modest regard for the truth and a deep love of racist, sexist, and homophobic slurs. And no, by the way, that is not a political statement. Okay, that is something. Yeah, that is something he himself would be like, you've left out a whole bunch of adjectives. Yes, all of those things are true, but there's also, and he'd have a longer list for you. Now, his star has dimmed in recent years, especially after he mocked a college student testifying to Congress about birth control as a slut and a prostitute. Advertisers have fled his platform, but enough remain, and he's a huge ratings draw who has impacted radio and the culture. No Rush? Well, then you don't get Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly or so many others. If and when he retires or is gone, it will open up a huge hole in radio, just as Judge Judy retiring would create a huge opportunity in TV syndication. But hopefully, because we're not, you know,
hateful.
Really hateful, it will happen on his own terms and not cancer's. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal in terms of, just as we compared him to Judge Judy, he's still a big ratings draw and a big player in radio that will have a big impact. It's ghoulish to talk about that when someone becomes ill and they're still trying to work. But that's what people in radio have to think about. What are we going to do? We have to plan for the future. And, you know, if one wants to point out the irony of something, it's the fact that he has fought for years to deny other people basic health coverage. But thank God he has the money that he can get the best health care that everyone deserves. He is sure to get that. So, you know, we do not wish him ill health-wise, but there's the irony for you. He's got the money to make sure he can get the best health care in the world. Isn't that good? Everyone else deserves that as well.
When Taylor Swift was looking for a new label, everyone in the world vied for her talents. We tried to vie for them.
We except, did.
Yeah, there were two big problems. We had no money.
And no phone number. We couldn't reach her.
Yeah, well, okay, three. Okay, so no phone number. Also, we don't run a record label. Mm-hmm. Now, Sony was just one of the companies that lost out, even though they own a record label and have money. But it may be the only company that has lost twice. Taylor Swift signed a giant recording contract with Universal Music Group. She could have gone, well, anywhere in the world or just done it all on her own, but she chose Universal. Then Swift was looking for a new home for her music publishing, and she chose, well, Universal. The deal will cover all new music she writes, and eventually her entire past catalog, you know, as the rights to her older songs expire and they migrate to Universal from Sony ATV. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. There's a lot of money in publishing. We've said it for years. Paul McCartney was right. You want to own publishing. Michael Jackson was right when he listened to Paul McCartney. But the bigger story here, or the more interesting story, is relationships. We always think of this as money and deals and big multinational corporations. But when you're a creative artist, when you're a best-selling author, you have a powerful relationship with your editor. When you're in music, you have a powerful relationship with the people that you work with. When you're in television or film, you know, the people there matter. And when you go, well, gee, she had her publishing deal at Sony. I wonder why she didn't just join that company and, you know, bring it all under one roof in that step. You know, why did she go to a third company and then bring her publishing along later? Well, the fact is she gave a shout out when she announced this deal to Troy Tomlinson. He was the head of Sony ATV Nashville, where she worked with all her career. She worked with this guy. But then he took a job at Universal Nashville. So he had already left Sony ATV. So if they had kept Troy, if they'd kept him happy or given him what he needed to stay at Sony, she may have gone to Sony with her music label deal. Instead, in part, she followed Troy Tomlinson. She said, I got a great deal with that guy. I like him. She ended up at the Universal label knowing that he was already there at the Universal Nashville stance for music publishing. So those relationships matter a lot more than you think.
Well, and it's the same thing with agents. You know, if you represent three A-list stars, well,
and you
guess
move
what?
And you leave to go to another agency,
those stars go with you for the most part.
That's right. And speaking of all the money in music, it's not just in publishing; it's also in the labels. Warner Music Group announced they are going to go public.
That's right, and I think they'll probably do a little bit better than WeWork. That's all I'm saying. The Attorney General of California has not launched a formal investigation into the Recording Academy and the Grammys. Not yet. However, it has received multiple complaints about the Board of Trustees, how a rape allegation against former head Neil Portnow was handled, the payment of millions of dollars of fees to two powerful law firms, and other questionable behavior. At least one complaint also highlights other expenditures, such as, and this just kills me, $770,000 for hospitality at a single event in September of 2016, which wouldn't be that bad if it was, say, you know, the Oscars or the Grammys. But no, this one involved only 200 people. That's it. The Academy's
only like $400 a person, right? Or $4,000 a person, $3,000 a person, $3,500 a person for one night.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. The Academy says it has launched its own internal investigation, but ousted head Deborah Dugan says, well, that too is already compromised because the investigator retained, guess who? It was Proskauer Rose.
No, it was chosen by Proskauer Rose.
Oh,
they
it was
recommended.
Chosen by?
They said, this is who we recommend to investigate us.
Right. So basically, it's like saying, don't worry, farmer. I'm going to get the fox to tell us how many hens are there in the hen house. So, yeah. Okay. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's going to be a big deal when the California Attorney General officially launches a formal investigation, and they will. There's too many different things going on. Do they regret hiring her? Well, they shouldn't, because they need to clean house, and she has actually started it by leaving, even if she couldn't do it while she was there. Oh, let me ask you a question. Warner Media has launched is closing a big deal for the Friends cast to do a reunion special. It's not going to be fiction. It's just going to be the gang sitting around, I guess, jawing about the glory days of making Friends. That's what it seems to be, a live special. They're offering the guys like $3 to $4 million a person to pop up and do a show. Our in-house film critic, Aaron Rich, says, oh my God, they've overpaid. That's insane. You know, for one 2-hour special, they're going to pay those people, like $24 million. Is that crazy? Is that stupid?
No. And I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm. At Sundance this year, they had they always have this little trailer that they do about the volunteers, because the whole thing is run by volunteers. Yes, they have staff, but the actual operations of, you know, ushers and ticket takers, etc., that's all volunteers. And they feature a number of volunteers. This year they had somebody who was an actor, but what they really want to be is a file clerk, because obviously that was their day job. Mm-hmm. They had somebody who was a VIP tour guide at Universal Studios. They had a beekeeper. They also had somebody who claimed to be a Friends expert, and she like opened her shirt and there was the Friends logo from the TV show.
Uh-huh.
This show is incredibly popular. And so if they're doing it to get people on HBO Max, it will work.
Right, but it's not a special of the show. It's just 2 hours of them jawing. Do they need that to have people want to rewatch the whole 10 or 11 seasons of Friends, or aren't they going to do that anyway?
I think they'll probably do that anyway, but this will be one more reason for people to sign up right now.
Just for that one special, so you feel it. Just like Netflix spent $200 million for The Irishman, you think that's a good use of their funds?
If they can get people to, let's put it this way, if they can get 5-7 million people to sign up for a month, right, so that they can watch this, and some of those people forget to cancel, most of them will, then it will be worth it.
Well, I don't think 5 million people are going to subscribe just to watch that one special, but we shall see. It'll certainly get them a lot of press.
That is true. Now, things that are getting a lot of press these days, well, that's the subject of our Inside Baseball segment this week. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I feel like a broken record from 10 years ago. And here's why. Here's how this will affect you. You're going to see either no television, no films, or you'll see a whole bunch that are horrible.
Okay? The Kardashians on marathon Kardashian shows.
Right. And that's because the Writers Guild of America voted this week to strike.
No, they did not vote to strike. No, they voted to agree and support the demands that their leadership is going to be making.
Right. Correct. Yes. Okay. So now they voted 91%. Now the vote was 3,028 to 308, which doesn't sound like much, but then when you think about it, in 2017, that same vote was 1,626 to 69. So huge increase in people paying attention to this.
Right. So what they supported was what they're going to be fighting for. A lot of familiar things. They want paid family leave. They want to address uncompensated work. These days, they're finding more and more that writers are always sort of powerless unless you're really big, and they pay you to write something. They say, oh, you're going to give us three rewrites and a redraft. And, you know, they keep drip, drip, dripping you with extra work on top of it. They want to address the issue of writing teams and how you break down how people get paid and things like that. They want to increase minimum compensation across the board. As we know, TV shows and movies are more in demand than ever. There's all these profitable streaming services. Everybody's making hand over fist. There are more shows than ever. And yet, writers are going backwards. They're making the minimum or just above the minimum. So they're saying, how come everybody else is making big bucks and we're not, especially when there's no more a back end for most things. We know negotiations won't begin until the DGA is done making its deal with AMPTP, which stands for
the American Motion Picture and Television Producers.
That's right. It's the producers.
Or the Association of Motion Picture and Television Producers.
That's right. And we know the WGA current contract, that's the Writers Guild of America, their current contract ends on May 1st. So that's when we're talking about things getting really serious. But the biggest thing of all is that they want to include the demand that studios and production companies refuse to work with talent agencies who haven't signed on to the WGA agreement, where they ask talent agents to, hey, how about representing us instead of yourself?
Right. And the AMPTP says, hey, remember last year when we said, yeah, that's a no-go for us? We're
that
not
means,
gonna-
That means there will be a strike. Now, everybody at the Oscars who was willing to comment, all the powerful studio people and producers and the big, big writers with lots of money, they're like, oh, I hope there won't be a strike. We can compromise. We got to work together. We all want the same thing. It's like, yeah, but what the writers want is more money, and they want their agents to represent them, and they're ready to fight for it. And I feel like there is going to be a strike. There's no way the studios and the talent agencies are going to cave, even though more and more mid-level ones are not caving, but saying this is a reasonable demand and we're going to meet that. But the big three or big four aren't doing that. And the studios are not going to want to be hamstrung and get into this fight. I don't see how they're going to avoid a strike.
I think you're absolutely correct. There was a strike in 2007. I see another strike coming now. It's just inevitable. I don't think the DGA, which actually begins their negotiations with the AMPTP today, okay, right now as we're speaking, they're
negotiating. Enjoy the donuts and coffee.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to come to a very quick agreement, which means there will be even less time to do pattern bargaining with the Writers Guild and SAG. It's just going to be a mess.
And the writers have symbolically or literally fired all their agents who have not agreed to these demands, these terms, these new terms that they're asking for, which to me seem reasonable. I'm sorry, I've tried to see the other side, but I can't. You know, they want a package and they want to make more money than you do on the show you create. That doesn't seem fair to me. So I don't see how they can avoid it. They've gone that far. They're not going to stop now. And I think it has to be fought over and they have to fight for more compensation. They're saying, look, you're making more shows than ever and we're making less money than ever. How is that fair? It's not.
Yeah, and there it used to be that, you know, if you were a writer on one of these TV shows, you could actually make a good chunk of change just from syndication.
Right.
Well, guess what? That's gone. And so when you're earning the guild minimum, or even not a guild minimum, but a pretty penny, guess what? It's no longer you're earning that pretty penny, and of course you'll be paid for the rest of your life. You're earning that pretty penny, and that's it. You will never see another dime from those shows. And as far as movies go, in terms of free work, what that means is, you know, these producers will, and studios included, will say, as you mentioned, Michael, okay, the draft plus two rewrites. But then they'll come back and say, well, what about this scene? And can you do a little brush up on this other scene and inject a little bit more
comedy? It's out of control.
And so all of a sudden you find yourself working for thousands of hours, and you think I'm exaggerating, but writers will tell you their time is measured in hundreds and thousands of hours that they give up for free because, you know, they just want to see the film get made because that actually helps them more than asking for a little extra money. But mm-hmm. then what winds up happening is the producer or the studio says, you know what, we're going to go in it. Thank you for all that. We're going to go in a different direction. You might get story by credit. Maybe the film will never get made. Maybe it'll get made and you'll be nowhere on it. But thank you for your work. You've been paid, and that's it. Yes, you've been paid, but all those little extra touches that you did, you don't get paid for those.
Yeah. I mean, people said when the writers began to battle with agents and they had stories and, my God, it's dragged into the second week. And we're thinking, what are
we're
you talking
about? We're in 10 months now.
Yeah, this is not a weeks-long fight. This is a serious Armageddon. You know, this is writer-geddon. Forget vinyl-geddon. It's writer-geddon. There's going to be a writer strike. It's going to impact the entire business. It's going to be serious. People are going to suffer because it's hard when you don't work. A lot of these writers are making minimum as it is. They're not fat cats with tons of money. So it's a real sacrifice, but they're looking towards the future, and it's a tough call to make, but they're going to make it, and we're going to face a strike. I don't see how they can avoid it.
Well, maybe, didn't Kirk Douglas actually, he helped end the blacklist, right?
He absolutely did. Too bad he's not around to help us with this. Kirk Douglas died at 103. It's time for the obituary section, and Sperling's going to hate me. It's going to last longer than the in memoriam section of the Oscars.
Which was really so long that Billie Eilish was like, don't worry, I can improve on this whole McCartney-Lennon song. Let me sing this verse three times.
He had a more interesting career than I thought. I always think of him and Burt Lancaster sort of linked together. And Burt Lancaster was one of the first people to set up his own production company in the post-50s era and sort of forge his own path and help end the studio system in terms of that. And so Kirk Douglas followed in that path and did the same thing. He was an innovative actor. And, he was an interesting guy with a lot more blockbusters and notable works with top directors than I remembered. He did help to break the backlist by announcing Dalton Trumbo would script his big budget film Spartacus, the most notable film of his career, perhaps. That gave a big boost to director Stanley Kubrick, who Kirk Douglas also worked with on Paths of Glory. And for a decade, it was Universal's biggest hit ever. He was a big supporter of progressive causes. He was a goodwill ambassador all over the world. Towards the end of his life, he was an advocate for people who are living with stroke survivors. He did two big films with Vincent Minnelli I've never seen, The Bad and the Beautiful and the Vincent Van Gogh biopic, Lust for Life. But he made one of my favorite films of all time, Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole, a.k.a.
Such a good movie.
The
Such
Big Carnival, movie. Terrific, acidic, wonderful movie about the media. It's a great, great movie. But the list goes on. Out of the Past, which is a great noir, the boxing film Champion, which was his breakthrough, A Letter to Three Wives, Gunfight at the OK Corral, Detective Story, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
No, he was a living legend. Mm-hmm. I mean,
and this is cool. Of course, he's the father of Michael Douglas, and his stage career included doing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest on stage on Broadway. He could never get it turned into a film. He fought for it for years. He played the Jack Nicholson role, but he couldn't make it happen. And he shared the film rights with his son, Michael. Michael had a little bit more luck with it, of course. And Kirk Douglas said one point, he said, quote, "I made more money from that film than any I acted in. And I would gladly give back every cent if I could have played that role."
Wow.
That's
a quote. Yeah,
exactly.
You know, my own personal story with Kirk Douglas, I met him a couple of times, but one of the, before his stroke, and then after his stroke, I was working in Culver City. A film stew had an office on Washington Boulevard, and the old Culver Theater was there on the corner of, I can't even remember the corner, but it's on Washington Boulevard. And it's an old movie palace that was shut down and shuttered and just decaying. And one day I'm walking past it on the sidewalk and the door is open. No, I had never seen the door. The front door is wide open. And who should come walking out, walking to the black SUV parked in front, but Kirk Douglas. And I thought, well, I wonder what they're going to do in there. Well, about 6 months later, the Kirk Douglas Theater was announced, and it now is one of the
mainstay.
Yeah, it's now a mainstay.
That's terrific. I'm going to do the next obit, and if you try to do it, don't you dare try to do it. Come on, I dare you. I dare you to try to do this next obit.
You mean about TV star Robert Conrad of the Wild Wild West?
That's the one. He died at 84. He had two hit shows to his credit. One is Ba Ba Black Sheep, where he reveled in his tough guy image. The other, of course, is the Wild Wild West. James Bond in the West. That's the pitch for the show. Had a great title sequence, great gadgets, over-the-top villains, cliffhangers, humor. It was a fun show. I loved it as a kid. I have not watched it in many years, but that was one ripe for rebooting and remaking, and sadly they did a terrible job with it. That really was one that they bungled completely. It's a shame because it's such a fun property. But he also did TV commercials. He did one for the Ever Ready battery, and I can't remember why, but he would put the battery on his shoulder, and being the tough guy he was, he'd dare you to knock it off his shoulder, and he'd say, "Come on, I dare you." It's like, I don't know what the deal was, but it's hilarious and you still remember it. But you know, you have one or two hit TV shows, people will remember you forever.
And what happens if you have one or two or three or 50 hit books?
They still remember you. Mary Higgins Clark. She's the author and once dubbed the Queen of Suspense. She died at 92. She had more than 50 bestsellers to her credit. She died in Naples, Florida, near where I grew up. 100 million copies of her books were sold. Well, you write 50 of them and each sell a couple million, you're doing good. She had a new one out just in November, so she was writing right up to the end. These were not partnered with other people, though she did write a couple books with her daughter and another one that she collaborated on with another person. She had a formula. Her formula was nice people whose lives are invaded or upended by bad people. She would put women in peril, and then she would let them figure a way out. There was no shiny knight in armor to rescue the women. They did it themselves. And she repeated that formula over and over and over again and was very successful at it. She began as a switchboard operator in her teens when her dad died during the Great Depression, had to go to work right away. She would eavesdrop on all the conversations, including those of Tennessee Williams. And she said, "I never heard anything that interesting." And years later, somebody handed him a copy of one of her early breakout books. And he said, "I know a lot of people who can write better than this." So she said, "Well, we just weren't fans of each other."
Well, you know, the other day I went to the doctor, and the doctor's in the hospital, and I'm in the lobby. And there's a piano there, a grand piano, and every once in a while there's somebody who's retired, a senior citizen that's, you know, playing songs just for people in the lobby. And there was another guy, another senior citizen, standing above him, kind of shouting out names of songs for the person to play. And so as I walk away, I hear the MASH theme song. Suicide is painless. And I'm just like, wow, there's a blast from the past. And the next day, the co-creator of MASH, Gene Reynolds, dies.
Oh, had you heard it? Was that when it was announced, or like this was just prescient? Just happened to happen?
Just prescient. It was like literally last week, and then the very next day, I thought, really? Why am I hearing the MASH twice in 2 days?
Well, there's two things I like here. One is his career was a lot longer than I expected and involved a lot of different things. There's a mystery at the heart of his life, though, and there's a good anecdote. He was a child actor. He began in the Our Gang shorts, and he appeared in some Andy Hardy movies. When I looked him up, I went, oh, yeah, that kid. I remember him as a child actor. Then he transitioned to writer and producer and director, mostly in television, including The Tales of Wells Fargo, and the high school show Room 222, which was sort of a socially conscious show. So then, of course, he hit the jackpot with MASH, which he co-created with Larry Gelbart in 1972. I don't know why when someone said, hey, let's turn the Robert Altman film MASH into a TV series, everybody didn't just laugh and leave the room because it's such an awful idea. Not only did they do it, but they really kept the spirit of the film, all the best parts of the film, and cut out all the bad parts, the misogyny. But it's a remarkable thing. It's better than the movie in my mind, and it's pretty great for those first 5 years. He worked on it for 5 years through 1977, and then he left, and he launched the drama Lou Grant. There's another idea. Let's take lovable Lou Grant from the sitcom and turn it into a drama. What a crazy idea, but it worked. It was a really good show. I loved it as a kid. I don't think it holds up necessarily.
No,
but
it
was a good, hard-hitting show about journalism. They tackled, you know, topical issues, won all sorts of awards as a writer and producer on MASH and Lou Grant back-to-back 10 years from 72 to 82. And then he's in his 50s on the top of the world. Essentially, he was done. He'd worked for 50 years in showbiz practically, and except for some episodes and TV movies as a director after that, which all seem sort of like just sort of casual things, he never tried to do another show. He never seemed to do anything else. Maybe he just said, you know what? I've won the lottery twice. I'm done. I'm happy. I got more money than I know what to do with. I don't know why he really lost interest or just said, hey, you know, I'm happy to walk away. I'm happy now. I don't need any more. But I'd love to know why Gene Reynolds just said, yeah, I'm done. Maybe he tried to launch other stuff and couldn't get it off the ground. That seems unlikely given that track record of those two big shows. But there was a great anecdote in the New York Times. They said one of the most memorable moments of MASH that he directed, according to him, is not a specific episode, but the opening title sequence, which we've all seen 1,000 times. It shows two helicopters landing at the medical unit, presumably with casualties aboard. And then, of course, nurses and doctors and people running up there to help. Now, several assistant directors tried but couldn't get the shot he was after, and the actresses were just sort of trotting along, as he put it, in an oral history recorded for the DGA. So he took over, and he gave the women a simple direction. I said, they need you. And when he said that, and they shot the next one, and those women came flying out of that goddamn tent. He cursed. I'm sorry about that. They came flying out, he said. And that's the shot that you see on television. So I thought that was a really cool story. And the next time you watch MASH, that'll make you appreciate it all the more.
And, you know, that scene is shot in the Santa Monica Mountains.
That's right. Yeah, it's not in Korea.
Yeah. And that those hills, those mountains, that's where the Kobe Bryant crash. Mm,
and 40 was. Years later. A movie in Korea would win the Oscar for Best Picture.
Yes. Now, you know, Robert Altman, who directed MASH, every time I interviewed him a couple times, he'd always go and tell me the same thing. MASH, that was the first time we ever used the F word in a movie.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah. He's like, yes, the first time we ever used profanity in a movie.
Good for you.
I was like, you're really proud of that. You've told me that like 5 times.
He said, I am effing proud. I'm really effing proud of that. Well, tell me about Lucy Jarvis. She's a TV producer who died at 102. I wanted to say, stop saying women and people of color need to pay their dues, because for the beginning of TV and movies, when they've been given a chance, women and people of color have delivered. They've done it for decades. All you got to do is give them a chance. Case in point, Lucy Jarvis, a pioneering TV producer. She did groundbreaking TV documentaries. She was really good at introducing different parts of the world to other parts of the world. She gained access to China when that was very unusual in the 70s. She did a story set in the Kremlin. She got more access than anybody in Russian media ever got. And she says the most difficult one of all was the Louvre. Getting the French to let her put cameras in the Louvre and shoot things. They were like, no, mon Dieu. They were very, very difficult.
Ce n'est pas possible.
Oui. She also oversaw the first Barbara Walters interview special for ABC. That included Jimmy and Rosalind Carter and Barbara Streisand in 1976 and launched a franchise that would make ABC and Barbara Walters very happy for decades to come.
Well, you know, somebody that maybe not a lot of people knew about, but he was a baseball writer, and he wrote The Boys of Summer. He died at the age of 92. His name is Roger Kahn.
That's right.
So his work, without a doubt, a lot of people know about.
Yeah, he redefined nonfiction sports writing. He elevated it to new levels. He used some techniques from new journalism that you can find in The Right Stuff and elsewhere. He drew upon his own childhood and the society at large to set baseball in context. And, you know, it's about baseball. I love baseball. But before that, there was not a lot of serious nonfiction about the sport. Sports Illustrated did a list of the 100 most important and best and favorite sports books of all time, fiction, nonfiction, you name it. This is at number two. There is a boxing book that's number one, a collection of boxing articles. This is the first book written specifically as a book. And almost all of the books on that list, there are some from the 50s and 40s and 20s and 60s. Almost all of them come after The Boys of Summer. That's how important it is. Sports Illustrated called it a baseball book, the same way Moby Dick is a fishing book.
Well, technically, it is a fish. Anyway, also, wow.
I know, I was going to cut. I know. But this guy's fascinating.
Orson Bean?
Yes.
Yes. No, I've seen him. I saw him at the Geffen Playhouse, in fact.
He was a big character in L.A. theater, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And sadly, he was hit by a car over the weekend at the age of 91.
Yeah, when you die at 91, you should be able to say you slept, you know, you fell asleep in your bed and didn't wake up. And instead, this poor guy was hit by two cars. Hit by a car, fell down, hit by, oh my God, what an awful way to go. Poor man, but he had a great, great life. Everybody remembers this guy once you see him. He was a prolific character actor and raconteur. He did everything from game shows to drama to quiz shows to musical theater. He was on Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, playing the ornery shopkeeper. He had a recurring role on Desperate Housewives. But, I mean, he was on The Love Boat, The Twilight. He did everything from live
TV. If you saw him, you'd recognize him.
He did live TV for Playhouse 90 back in the 50s, right up to Grace and Frankie on Netflix with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin. That is a career. That spans everything, you know. He did Being John Malkovich in Anatomy of a Murder. But you know him because he was on thousands of game shows. If you're of a certain era, he was on Match Game and Super Password and To Tell the Truth constantly. And he did hundreds of appearances on The Tonight Show. He subbed for Johnny Carson and Jack Parr. He did 100 stints as guest host. That's like Burt Reynolds level guest hosting. I had no idea. And of course, he was on Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas. He was just that great talk show guest. If you needed someone, you could throw him on and he would always be entertaining. He was a Tony nominee for a musical. He broke through on Broadway with Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter. And politically, he went from a blacklisted communist to a hippie living out of a van and dropping acid with his wife and kids to a rock-ribbed Republican in his older age. And he says it was more dangerous in Hollywood to be a Republican than a communist.
Well, speaking of Republicans, somebody who is tied to a Republican, at least getting them out of office, is Alice Mayhew, who was the editor and a legendary editor for Simon & Schuster. But she was one of the editors on, if not the editor, on All the President's Men, which, of course, was about Richard Nixon and helped, you know, kind of show him which way the door opened.
Well, you talk about a signal book, just like The Boys of Summer, which came out in 1972, though actually Sports Illustrated had it as 1971, but the New York Times says 1972. All the President's Men came out in 1974. That is a landmark work of journalism as well. Practically created a subgenre of Hollywood, not of, of Washington, D.C. nonfiction, and Alice Mayhew was responsible for a lot of it. She had an early left field hit with the feminist classic Our Bodies, Ourselves, but then she did All the President's Men, and that really took her off. She did a lot of important work. Taylor Branch's multi-volume work, Parting the Waters, about Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. A lot of hits for Doris Kearns Goodwin and Stephen Ambrose. A lot of work with public figures like Jimmy Carter and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She did Walter Isaacson's books. That's her parting shot in a way. His biographies of Steve Jobs and Leonardo da Vinci, beloved by all the writers she worked with. The work she did with Doris Kearns Goodwin and Stephen Ambrose is tainted by the fact that both of those popular historians were correctly found guilty of plagiarism. That didn't seem to taint them ultimately or Alice Mayhew, though it should have, but she did a lot of great work. Here's a fascinating fact. When Simon & Schuster celebrated its 90th anniversary, they asked their staffers to vote on their 90 favorite books published by the company over its entire history. Almost one third were edited by Alice Mayhew. 29 of them were books that she did. That is amazing.
And you know what's amazing? is probably the length of this show at this point.
I know. I thought they were just such fascinating deaths. Such cool lives, you know. I just couldn't help
myself. That
should
be a podcast unto its own. Fascinating deaths.
It could be.
It's actually fascinating people who died, not fascinating deaths. But that's
fascinating deaths would be a different podcast.
Right,
we
exactly.
We fell from this floor to the ceiling. We explain how.
There's a YouTube video. Look it up. It involves cats. Well, you know, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. And please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. You can find that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as those ways to contact us. Dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox. And on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, and they can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's doyouhearthepeoplesing.com.
See the beginning of the show for that reference.
You've probably forgotten it by now.
That's probably true.
Cast album of Les Mis.
Yes. You know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage on that particular website, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his entertainment writing can be found. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
What if we co-hosted? What if there was no host? What would happen right now?
We'd have to get Steve Martin and Chris Rock to open the show for us.
Yes, not hosting it, but just appearing at the beginning to do a monologue. Please continue.